I also am grateful to my advisor who works in material science. He introduced me into nonlinear mechanics 3 years ago and then gave me complete freedom of doing whatever I want. It was like I was taught to swim. I was thrown into the water and then in 2 minutes I know how to swim. But it took 3 years to get some results in nonlinear elasticity, and part of them I'm presenting here. I don't really feel quite comfortable for at least 2 reasons. First, you're tired. And second, this is not in the mainstream of this conference workshop, or maybe in the mainstream of any event of that kind. But there are a couple of nice touches of a beautiful theory, genetic function theory, somewhere in the second part of this presentation, and this makes it worthwhile to present, maybe. So the best way to get into some area is to follow best patterns. I started to learn some old papers in nonlinear elasticity, and one of them was the seminal paper by John Ball of 1977. As you know probably what it was about, you probably all know what it was about, but nevertheless, for those of you who don't, I want to remind some basic things very quickly. Oh, there's some electricity here. Static. Wow. So in static problem of nonlinear elasticity, you are looking for deformation, which in mathematical sense is just mapping from some domain omega in R3 to u of omega in R3, or in Cartesian coordinates, usually capital X is used as vector for Cartesian coordinates in the reference configuration, and lowercase x for Cartesian coordinates in the current or deformed configuration. The differential is called in the area of mechanic deformation gradient, and to simplify the exposition, I will restrict myself to a class of nonlinearly elastic materials which satisfy so-called incompressibility constraint or condition, or which is highly nonlinear, and it says that the determinant of this deformation gradient must be zero, or zero almost everywhere. To make transition from the balance law, which represents the equilibrium, which represents the balance of linear momentum in nonlinear elasticity, to make it legitimate, you need some assumptions. The basic assumption is that the material is hyperelastic, which means that there is some scalar function called elastic potential, stored energy density, or energy density, many names. It has to satisfy some physically realistic assumptions, which I omit in this presentation, but maybe I will mention when I need some of them. And the simplest version of variational problem, so no body forces and no applied tractions, is to find this deformation or mapping that delivers minimum to this expression, integral of stored energy, in some set of admissible deformations, which will be specified later. And this is an example of the celebrated Borg's theorem. Just one of them, and actually he did everything in more general, setting. It was in Orlich spaces, of which Sobolev spaces are in Sobolev spaces particular case, and for general N, but later on in a very good book by Philippe Sirlet, the results of Paul were translated in terms of sobering spaces. And this is, as I said, just an example to give you a flavor of what I'm heading to. This is an admissible set. Boundary conditions are prescribed on part of the boundary with non-zero measure, Lebesgue measure, and they are given the given function, known function, u sub zero. To make possible application of the direct method, the main three hypotheses were adopted. Polyconvexity, and this is the most novel element in Wolf's development. This is more feasible convexity property than famous quasi-convexity, which cannot be characterized completely yet. This can be verified. One word is missed here. It is continuous convex function, because there are convex functions which are not continuous. This is a standard convexity coerciveness condition, and hypothesis 3 just means that the admissible set is not empty. So these are trivial things. Again, just to show you the pattern I followed. And under certain restrictions on growth parameters in coerciveness inequality, you can claim, Wolf claimed, that total energy assumes its minimum in A. In spite of numerous investigations related and raised in Wolf's paper, some commonly used materials are not covered by his theory. They're ruled out by restrictions on the growth parameters. In particular, he himself mentioned that among those materials is Neo-Hookean material, which is considered as the simplest nonlinearly elastic material, toy model, or in a more formal manner, it is pilot problem. So, Neo-Hookean material is given by strain energy density of this form, material parameter, usually in this form, and then trace of and this is Cauchy-Green stress deformation tensor, which usually is noted by C. And again, this incompressibility condition. So it's incompressible version of. Incompressible version of. Neo-Hookean material. I'm not going to talk about this material. The idea was, the motivation was, to include material with this rate of growth, which is 2, into existence analysis. So Wolf mentioned that it is not possible to apply in three-dimensional case his theory to materials with growth for strain energy which do not include dependence on the matrix of cofactors. I show that. Yeah, there is this matrix of cofactors included in the coercivity condition. When there is no dependence on this second term here, then, let's see, you don't have to look at it at this time, then the restrictions for existence theory in three-dimensional case for Wolf's theory becomes greater or equal 3. Or even if you choose a smaller admissible set, when you understand determinant in distributional sense. I will not go into details here, but later on I show you a particular case. So in some generalized sense, then the restriction is less than 9/4. And in more general, in the n-dimensional case, the formula has been derived, n squared over n minus 1, or n plus 1, for general n, and it was shown by counterexample that there is no weak continuity of determinant if you allow p to be equal to 9/4. It was done by Dakarogna in 92. So this is motivation. I want to extend Bohr's theory to not full three-dimensional deformation, but for a subclass of three-dimensional deformations, namely deformations that have axial symmetry. These are three-dimensional, but not general three-dimensional. And you expect that since transitions from n equals 3 to n equals 2 relax those restrictions, then there will be some relaxation for this subclass of three-dimensional deformation. This turned out to be true and not very hard to do. I just followed step by step Bohr's argument. That was a nice process, except for the moments when I have to adjust something and depart from his kind of reason. There were only two moments, and I'll explain them in a minute. So this is the setting for my axisymmetric deformations. You can see that the domain, which is represented like that, some 2D domain D in RZ, like suppose you have cylindrical body and you cross it, you draw the plane through the axis, and the body is, look at this line, the body is hollow. There is hole, not necessarily like a cylinder, circle, some hole in it. And so you cross this body, half of this cross section is the domain D. And it should be nice. I won't go into detail. Let's say it is Lipschitz or strongly Lipschitz. At some point it must be strongly Lipschitz, but for the moment it could be just Lipschitz. And you consider axisymmetric deformations given by the ANSYS. This is the ANSYS. So there are three unknown functions. One represents radial extension contraction. The tau represents the angular deformation twist. And Z represents axial extension contraction. This is a standard exercise to find the deformation gradient. In this case, looks like this. And here's the first problem. From coercivity inequality, I still have it here. From coercivity in both theory, you get that the unknown functions belong, combining this with some standard argument using boundary condition, that these unknown functions in three-dimensional case belong to Sobolev space. But here, for this deformation gradient, you can't specify the space to which twist function belongs because it is coupled with R. And also, originally, R capital is separated away from zero. But after deformation, you know nothing about the radial component. It can become zero. And so you can't get the proper space from this representation. In order to obviate this problem, in the first part, I introduced new dependent variables. They look very simple. They are related by those very simple equations with old ones. So now we have triples of unknown function, psi, eta, and z. Nice thing is that, again, after very simple manipulations, you separate all those functions, and moreover, your integrand, moreover, this quantity becomes quadratic with respect to function R and the derivatives, all derivatives of the unknown functions. It doesn't mean that you get linear problem because you still have this highly nonlinear condition which enters the description of the admissible set. So in terms of new and known functions, this deformation tensor takes the form, this form, in, I would say, obvious notations, but if no, I'm ready to explain. This U is a triple of psi, eta, z. This is derivative of each of them with respect to the variable R capital, and this is just standard norm in RC. Same thing here, and ellipsis stand for symmetric expressions because this is a symmetric tensor. It turns out that if you introduce this tensor F sub 0, just like a guess at first, then corresponding construction F sub 0 transpose F sub 0 gives the same tensor. So you can replace this physically meaningful F deformation gradient with this expression. And turns out that this is not formal substitution because this quantity also has physical meaning. This is deformation gradient, but in Cartesian coordinates. So there is this interplay between Cartesian coordinates and cylindrical coordinates here. This is in Cartesian coordinates, deformation gradient evaluated at omega equals zero. So in this case, the coercivity conditions works just like it does in Bolz's theory, and you get nice functional spaces for unknown functions. And I'll do it, and I'll show the result in a moment. Now, the incompressibility condition in terms of psi, eta, and z has this expression, and I intentionally wrote it in this form, not with 1 here. I can divide by 2r, and this is the determinant. But I need some properties of the expression. It should be quasi-affine, like it was and it worked in the context of Bolz's theory. That's why I introduced this counterpart called the del. It has the properties needed to go through the Bolz argument. Again, I'm not going into details. And you transform the energy, and it becomes like that. Here's another problem. And when I was at a conference in Princeton on quasi-convexity, I had a chance to talk to Bolz for several minutes, to John Bolz. And he told me that when you change the... when you have differential formulation like equilibrium equation and some conditions under which it is equivalent to variational problem, then you somehow change your variational problem, simplify it, then you have to prove the equivalency because the equivalency can be lost. And later on, I found example and meaningful examples of that. If you simplify the ansatz to far, then you lose some terms in corresponding Euler-Raghanian equation, so you lose this equivalency. So you have to prove this equivalency. This is rather subtle question, and recently I found several interesting papers on this reduction in dimensionality based on gamma convergence. It is about rigorous mathematical justification of classical mechanical theories, like in plates or in rod theory. But I didn't want and wasn't able probably to go that far here. And in my committee, no one is aware of gamma convergence. So I did it in a very straightforward way. Namely, I found Euler-Lagrange equations for this reduced functional, and I compared it with the original equilibrium equations. And it turned out they differ by a factor 2r. So when R is separated from 0, it's fine, they are equivalent. in this context, I'm happy with this. I can proceed. I have this equivalence. But maybe there are some subtleties, and I'll be grateful if you point out them in this moment, in this. Here's the main theorem. It's kind of frightening, but again, since it's late, you can concentrate. So there are different admissible sets. But since I want to focus on the strain energy that depends only on the deformation gradient and not on the matrix of cofactors, we omit the first two lines. And so A super P is a set of a triples of functions from this Sobolev space satisfying boundary condition and compressibility condition. And the difference of this and that is in this capital D here. This is what I said. This is this del quantity in generalized sense. How much time do I have?
Oh, sure. 5 minutes.
5 minutes? Wow. So then we concentrate on just the line number three. And so it to this corresponds part C in the theorem, which says that for P greater than 2, there is a minimizer in this A super P set. So what did I do? I reduced the restrictions for three-dimensional case from P greater or equal 3 to P greater than 2, which is good. But I wanted to include Neo-Hookian materials, so materials with Neo-Hookian growth. It turns out that this is marginal case for that. It is tempting to include this case. One of the obstacles is that if you have function with natural Sobolev exponents like omega is Rn, and this is, oh, it's notation from Russia, I'm sorry. Yeah, when you have the second two, then you write not W, it's hard to do it. So if you have function in the domain Rn, and with this natural exponent, they belong to all Ln, but not to L infinity. They're not continuous. They're not continuous. And it is the continuity that we need, because the determinant has a form I'll show you in a minute. So in order to overcome this difference, this obstacle, we need some properties of functions of finite distortion. This is what I said is the most exciting moment, and I have only 2-3 minutes for that. Wow. So we need some properties of functions of finite distortion. This is the definition, again, for those of you who are not familiar. There was a nice book recently published in the year 2001 by Iwaniek and Martin. It's a geometric functions theory, and it combines a lot of materials known for quasi-conformal, quasi-regular mapping, and the generalization of those mapping is the class introduced by Ball, actually. So his paper stimulated investigation into mathematics too, not only in mechanics. And so this is the definition. The main part here is this line. And here are combined properties of functions of finite distortion that are needed along the way, but I'm not going to show you proof. So I remove that. I'll just mention that very important is this property number 2, which is called the estimate for the modulus of continuity. So those functions from Sobolev space with natural exponent have, each class has continuous representatives. And this is the key issue. This is what will allow to include this marginal case. Now, back to axisymmetric description. Now, I add just one restriction. I separate from zero the radius in the distorted in the deformed configuration that allows me to deal with triples of R, tau, z, and using the properties of mapping of finite distortion and my assumptions, I can prove that this is a mapping from this class. This is a function of finite distortion. I'm saying this is a couple of functions from U, from this triple, R and Z, compose, give you a mapping of finite distortion that says that R and Z are continuous. You can choose continuous representative. Very strong statement, but it relies on those deep properties of function of finite distortion. It says that if you have weak convergence, then on the compact sets, you will get uniform convergence. And this gives you this key result in existence theory that admissible set for those triplets of functions is weakly closed. And the existence follows. The second issue, I don't have any time, right? That's right. Okay. I'm sorry for that. Just the most exciting moment is always left, you know, overboard. Just to them, 1 minute for each. There is one more remarkable property of mappings of finite distortions. It was known for quasi-regular mappings, but was carried over to mappings of finite distortion relatively recently in 1993 by Iwaniak and Zverev, and it says that those mappings are open and discrete. And so again, in a very simple manner, using all assumptions, we can show that this two-dimensional mapping V composed of two components, R and Z, is open and discrete. And this allows us to strengthen known theorems on injectivity. If we also include standard condition of which leads to injectivity almost everywhere, which was introduced by Sirley and Natchez, then combined with openness, injectivity almost everywhere gives you global injectivity. You can drop those things almost everywhere. And this is the most novel element in all development. So you can follow step by step to known papers, but this is kind of nice surprise that you can strengthen the statement for this subclass of three-dimensional deformations, because in addition to injectivity almost everywhere, you have openness, and therefore you have actually homeomorphic mapping, because if you have continuous, open, and bijective mapping, then this is a homeomorphic. And there are papers on the properties of the inverse mapping. This is paper by Fonseca and Gamba. Inverse mapping is also pretty nice. It resides in Sobolev space. That's it.